If you're ready to confront your destiny, if this is the moment that you've been praying for, tune in and listen to your cosmic cheerleader, Commander Lady Athena, for cosmic pep talks, for closet Christs. The show is the voice of the Ashtar Command. The call is for you to step forward into your greatness. Be listening on Wednesday. We have an appointment with destiny.
Greetings in the divine love and light of the One Divine Presence. I'm Commander Lady Athena, and you're listening to the voice of the Ashtar Command. This evening our seminar topic is, All Things, Our Lessons, God Would Have Us Learn. So let's take a deep breath and come into perfect alignment with the highest part of you that you can reach into. And you do that by simply intending to reach that place. It's always there. It's always waiting for us to turn our attention to it. It is the beloved that you are. That is also God. So ask if you would like to, what is the lesson you would have me learn? What is the lesson that you would have me learn in this cycle of my life? With love, man is God. You are not the body, a bundle of flesh, blood, and bones. Neither are you the unmanifested desires or the unmanifested mind. You are also not the infatuated delusion that thwarts your liberation. You are the eternal Lord, if only you would recognize your innate power. The fulfillment of desires is what causes further desires to arise. Desires are like the threads in a cloth. They're all knitted together and form what we call the mind. The mind is driven to external things through the senses, and thus becomes attached. And where there is attachment, there is bondage, for all unfulfilled desires cause further births. The only way out is to offer all acts, all desires, your very life itself to the Lord. When you do all things in His name, and in service to His purposes that He would have you fulfill, then no further bondage will hold you here. For all of the results of your actions then go to the Lord itself, and you don't incur any more bondage of karmic indebtedness to this dimension. It takes great learning to recognize that all things are lessons that God would have us learn. And I think probably one of the most important ones is this. And this is from the Bhagavad Gita. Whoever among devotees dedicates all acts to me with no other thought, whoever meditates on me, serves me, worships me, remembers me, knows that I am always with him, ever providing for him in this world and in the next. I myself will bear the burden of his welfare. This is from Sai Baba's Gita Vahini, chapter 18. And he has this to say also from the same source. When one has obtained the state of realizing the divinity in every being, when every instrument of knowledge brings the existence of that divinity, when it alone is seen, heard, tasted, smelled, and touched, man becomes undoubtedly a part of the body of God and lives in him and with him. When this duty to your own progress is taken up, you will get a new strength at the very first step. You will thrill to a new and purer joy. You will taste the fullness of bliss. You will be refreshed by a new holiness. So those are the main lessons that gradually we come to realize as we progress in our spiritual inquiry, in our process of realization. The entire cosmos is but a projection of the mind. And yet, it is also important that we are here in the state that we have attained in terms of our realization. You can't, for example, jump necessarily from one class to another. There's a progression of unfoldment in the decodement and releasing of the informational light packets that we call the encodements of living light and living sound. These are specific coordinates for every person and incarnation here. There are no two alike. And that's why only you can decode your own mystery. The God within you, which is you and your highest self, is your only partner in this revelatory journey. And therefore, that's why it is so important to seek your own counsel, to learn to go within, and to evoke and call forward a response from that higher part of yourself, which sometimes you can hear, not necessarily in an audible voice, but certainly there is a response when you ask inwardly of the Lord for an answer. It often appears as sentences that simply start to flow into your awareness. And you learn to heed that without censoring, without curtailing and critiquing. Just allow the information to be downloaded and then sit with it and contemplate it and see how it applies to the question that you have presented. So the world is truly a dharma kshetra, which means a field for the exercising of righteousness. The world is full of problems, and that is how we learn to spiritually surmount all problems by changing how we view life. First comes the changing of perception about how we look at life. And when you see that it is a field for the exercising of righteousness, that it is but a projection of the mind, that the life is designed to have problems and challenges that test and train the exercising and externalizing of your own self-mastery, then you can begin to make friends with your life and your life pattern and begin to see all things as lessons that God would have you learn. It's a good exercise to do in your journal, to pick an area that you may be struggling with or some process that you are undergoing, and ask, what is the lesson, Lord, that you would have me learn in this? And then write down what you're receiving have tea with it, which simply means to contemplate how and in what way this response applies to your situation, and how might you cooperate in learning the lesson. One of the biggest keys to life and getting it to flow is to learn to accept that which is, change what you can, and learn to cooperate with what is. It's in cooperating that you begin to unfold the understanding. And so you don't ask, first of all, well, why? You cooperate. You accept. And then gradually the understanding, if you need it, sometimes there's nothing to be understood except it's just another lesson, move through and keep going. But if you really need to have a greater understanding, then, and only then, the understanding begins to appear. So nothing leaves our life, no condition, until it has taught us what it has come to teach. So it is helpful, I believe, to remember that our life involves a learning curriculum we've enrolled in with a personal lesson plan for each area of our life. And absolutely nothing about our life is at random. There is a specific purpose that we are here to fulfill, lessons we are to learn, and challenges that we are to face and overcome. Our life has an overall theme. Have you ever thought of your life as having a theme? Or a theme song, like a melodic refrain that keeps wafting in and out? I just heard the Beatles song. It's been a hard day's night. I've been working like a dog. The divine spirit has a great sense of humor, too. And so, you know your particular lesson focus shifts and changes as you learn in one area and move on to the next lesson. So when you journal, it is also useful to write down the areas that you sense that you are here to master in this lifetime. And what are your greatest areas of challenge? And what are your areas of greatest gifting and your strengths and your abilities? What is it that you find yourself doing automatically that you can now recognize as having been a lesson well learned? You know, you got to have some brownie points and golden stars in there, too. I remember that when I enrolled in the Arcane School, which is an esoteric training for discipleship, back in 1969, they had me fill out a really extensive questionnaire examining the intention behind wanting to undergo esoteric training. And while I don't remember the exact, all of the questions, there were some that I thought were quite interesting that probably we would all benefit from asking ourselves. And the questions were designed to really take you deeper into self-awareness and self-appraisal. That's different from self-judgment. Because you know you're not the body, not the mind, not the behavior. You're none of those things. You are the eternal one that is simply pretending to have a human experience to experience itself in individualization as a separate soul complex, if you will. And you can appraise the overall integration and behavior without making it either right or wrong. You just look to see what's there. And to see, kind of like a sculptor, where you need to maybe do a little chip here and a little smoothing there, and, you know, you make yourself a masterpiece, a work of art, in coordination with the guidance of the inner master. So here is a question that I thought was really stuck out in my mind. The question was, do you have any prejudices? Now, a prejudice, of course, would be a prejudging attitude against or for any particular thing, such as race, culture, color, creed, lifestyle, etc., and so on. I remember at the time I said no. And now, you know, many years later, I say, well, how could I possibly said no? You know, if you think of it deeply enough, you'll recognize that you probably have many prejudices you didn't realize, you even had. And remember, all judgments block the light. One of the important things in coming into accepted discipleship, which is what the Arcane School is designed to train you for, so that you can become a conscious co-worker of the spiritual forces of light. One of the purposes is to develop a consciousness that has harmlessness as its underlying motive, so that you have a sense of underlying goodwill towards everyone and everything. And that critical attitude that goes into judgment and prejudice is something that is a great block to further progression spiritually. It's actually something, one of the first things that we really, really need to drop to make further spiritual progress, because it's completely a product of the ego and its negative aspects, its most negative aspects, which are prejudicial and judgmental. So, another question was, of what are you the most afraid? I think I also answered, I'm not afraid of anything. And again, you know, when you really study yourself, you'll find that even deep, as I found out, deep in your cellular memory, there's a great fear of losing the body that comes up with the basic self or the body elemental. So we always have fear somewhere embedded in the body, because the body, according to the Course of Miracles, is like a defense and a fence, a fortress, within which the ego seeks to hide. Without a body, you see, the ego doesn't have any means of operating, because it takes the form of your separative, that separative and separating and judging part of your mind. It's not your whole mind, it's just part of the mind. But it is the part that keeps loving outside and separate, because love is the biggest threat to the ego. It causes it to dissolve. So the question, again, was another one. How much do you allow fear to influence your decisions? That's interesting. So what do you understand, another question, what do you understand to be the purpose of life in general, and your life in particular? Which spiritual values most characterize your life expression? Spiritual values would be things like freedom, love, harmony, peace, truth, understanding, righteousness, you know, things of that nature. And usually if you look at yourself, there are certain must-haves that you will have established in your life. A must-have for me is freedom. I think probably that's my predominant value, is freedom. And another one that's important for me is harmony. You know, the consciousness has always been one which, wherever she was, there was the desire to establish harmony. So look at your own life and see those absolute must-haves in terms of the values and what you really find that you need to have in place in your life and in the relationships that you attract into your life. And it's interesting because when you have a value, for example, like freedom, like I do, you'll often be put in life lessons where you are constricted and confined so that you have to find freedom within the situation itself. And, of course, that freedom that you really find when you are really restricted physically is inner freedom. And that's the only place that freedom begins. It's from that sense of spiritual inner emancipation that the outer sense of freedom begins to manifest. But you don't know that when you're initially looking to be free in the outer world. There's no freedom in the outer world. Yeah, it's another one of those illusions that we go seeking for that we don't find. And the other one was harmony. Well, if you have a value system that prioritizes harmony, you're going to be put into lessons that require you to find that place of harmony and peace within yourself in the midst of outer disharmonious situations, chaos, and so forth. You learn to live in your own inner citadel of peace and harmony. And you find that when you are centered in your own peace, that has like a ripple effect into your environment. It's amazing. You know, when we bought our property, Prana, which is now called the Peace Theological Seminary and College of Philosophy, and Peace Labyrinth and Gardens, when we first moved there, it was in the middle of basically a ghetto. I mean, there were people doing drive-by shootings. There was lots of gang activity. Two of our people got shot. They weren't killed, but they were injured by gunshot wounds right out in front of the property. You heard four-letter epithets flying through the air day and night. It was a wild and woolly place, and of course we had all hoped that our ashram would be out in the woods and, you know, some paradisical kind of forest setting. But alas, that was not to be. But we planted a peace pole with the several different languages represented that neighborhood was a mixture of several ethnic groups. And we began that process of radiating that inner peace that we had within ourselves from our spiritual practices, and also the philosophy that we had embraced and that we lived from. And gradually it was amazing. The entire neighborhood changed. And now some, 30 years, 30, I don't know. We bought the ashram because of a vision that I had, a dream, with Satya Sai Baba. And we had been looking for property. This was John Roger and myself and my husband. We had looked for property all over the place, and nothing really was the right place. So I had a dream of seeing Sai Baba standing on the balcony of a beautiful big white mansion, and the balcony was right over the entrance doorway. And about a week later, John Roger called my husband and I. We were living in Santa Barbara, and wanted us to come down and look at this property that he was considering to purchase for our spiritual community. And so we came down, and as we drove into the driveway of this mansion, which was the old Bugsby Berkeley, the silent film director's original mansion home, it was just an absolute gorgeous mansion. As we drove into the driveway, I said, John Roger, I just had a dream of this place. And he put his hand on my arm and he said, tell me the whole dream. And so I said, I saw Sai Baba standing over that entranceway on that balcony. And he had his hand raised, which means, have no fear, I am blessing, I am blessing. And John Rogers said, that's the sign we've been waiting for. From spirit, we will purchase this property. And that was after we had made a trip. I had gone with my yoga teacher, Indra Devi, and John Roger. and a group of 48 other individuals, and we had gone to see Sai Baba for the first time in 1972. And we were the largest American group to go see Swami in those early days. So anyway, that was a bit of a segue off the point here, but I forgot where I was before. But the important thing is that everything in our life is revealing God's plan and purpose for us. Everything. I don't care what it is. It is to draw you nearer and dearer to God and to cause you to live in such a way that you have full reliance and confidence upon God. A big, big area of training and teaching for me as a parent came with learning to release the cares and worries and concerns I had about my daughter to Baba. I was, how old was she? She must have been about 7 or 8 years old when I discovered Sai Baba in this lifetime. And he said that once he has accepted a person, once that person has come to him, that from then on he takes care of the whole family. And he has often said, your children are now my responsibility. That doesn't mean that we shirk our duty as parents. No, not at all. We still have to fulfill our dharma, which is our duty, our rightful duty as parents. But we also know that Sai Baba is now taking care of them, so no really awful thing is going to happen. They're going to be advanced to a higher state where maybe the karma is greatly, greatly diminished. Sai Baba says the moment you lay eyes on him, all of your sins are forgiven. So there's like an umbrella of blessing that goes over that whole family. And I believe that extends forward and backward quite a few generations. So, and what I'm saying applies to anyone who has fully and completely yielded their life to God, whether it's Sai Baba or Jesus Christ or the mystical traveler, preceptor consciousness, whatever your spiritual model is, know that it is the one and the same spirit, divine spirit, that is recognized, loved, and adored through many, many cultural valences and names and forms. And when you first experience your own inner divinity, you begin to realize that. That's when that sense of my guru is better than your guru, that's when that vanishes. And you can always tell people who haven't had that experience yet, because they're the ones out there fighting in the name of their quote-quote God, forgetting that we all have one Father, Mother, God. We're all children of one Creator. And it doesn't matter what you call that Creator. That Creator answers to every name and responds to every devoted heart. So realizing that essential oneness is the sunum bonum of all spiritual practices. So there were many other questions that were on that Arcane School questionnaire, but the important thing is to realize that those are questions that really begin to give an overall lesson format for our incarnation. We began to get a sense of, oh wow, yeah, this is who I am. This is the context within which I'm operating, at least at this time and cycle of my life. And I want to share with you a very beautiful letter that Sai Baba wrote, I believe this was to Dr. Hislop, a friend of mine, in 1975. After long searches here and there, in temples and in churches, in earths and in heavens, At last you have come back, completing the circle from where you started to your own soul, and find that he for whom you have been seeking all over the world, for whom you have been weeping and praying in churches and temples, on whom you were looking as the mystery of all mysteries shrouded in the clouds in nearest of the near, is your own self, the reality of your life, body and soul. That is your own nature. Assert it, manifest it. It is truth, and truth alone that is one's real friend and relative. Abide by truth, tread the path of righteousness, and not a hair on your body will ever be injured. Meditation is nothing else but rising above desires. Renunciation is the power of battling against evil forces and holding the mind in check. With love and blessings, Sri Satya Sai Baba. And there's a progression as we unfold spiritually. There's a progression. You have a sense, first of all, that you are in the light, and that is an expression of duality. Then you progress into this next stage, which is qualified non-duality. And in that stage, you believe that the light is in me. And finally, you progress beyond duality and beyond qualified non-duality into the state of absolute monism, where you can say, I and the light are one. And likewise, our relationship with God begins to change as we progress spiritually. At the physical level, you have the sense that God is my master and I am your servant, Lord. That would be duality. At the mental level, you will have the sense of, I am a spark of thine divine self, which is qualified non-duality. But at the atmic level of pure spirit, you will have the sense that you and I, Lord, are one. Jesus referred to these three types of relationships when he said, I am my Father's messenger. That was duality. I am my Father's son. That was qualified non-duality. And finally, I and my Father are one. That's non-duality, or pure monism. And also in qualified non-dualistic terms, Jesus once said, the kingdom of heaven resides within you. So these are progressions that we move through very, very naturally in our spiritual progression. We don't have to do anything really but stay on the path and keep our eyes open. And gradually we find that we arrive at our destination. Now you must have observed that in this material world, everything must be maintained in good working condition or it will rapidly return to rust and dust. In fact, Sai Baba is often heard to say, rest is rust. and you know, this applies to everything. Our physical body, our mind, our home, our automobile, our relationships, including our most important relationship with God. Everything begins to fall apart until we come present and take responsibility for maintaining our creations, the things that we have drawn into our life and are therefore responsible for. So the old adage of what you don't use, you lose, kind of applies here also. You know, I was a former circus performer and an athlete and a professional dancer, but I was shocked at how rapidly my rock-hard body turned into flab after only a few years of not working out. How could decades of hard physical training and conditioning vanish so quickly? But what happened, I suddenly lost interest in putting so much time and attention into my physical body after I quit dancing professionally, and instead I became unbalanced in another area. I spent all of my time meditating and studying and writing. And while I was taking really good care of my mind and spiritual areas, I was ignoring the needs of maintaining the physical body. Now, this is a major lesson, I think, for all of us in physical incarnation, that we need to maintain balance and taking care of every area of our life. If we get too overly focused and out of balance in one area, then the rest starts to go down the drain. And it's, you know, it's a downward spiral of decline unless you're constantly on your game here. That's just the way the physical dimension is set up. So it was interesting that during the time when I first started teaching classes in esoteric science and meditation, what I noticed was some of the students that were coming to the classes were quite elderly, and they had incredibly vibrant minds. In fact, some of those who attended, and I was just a really young teacher in training at that point. These were all theosophists in their 50s and 60s and 70s, and one man was even 98 years old, and they were all intellectually vibrant and brilliant. And I noticed that many esotericists who meditated regularly and studied, deep philosophical mind-stretching materials like the Alice Bailey and the Blavatsky teachings, that they were also very sharp mentally. And as a youngster, I was actually mentored by a man in his 70s, a woman, some say, was 116 when she passed over, and another woman who was 100. And every one of these esotericists were as sharp as a tack. Why? Well, they maintained mental health through using their minds in deep spiritual study and abstract thought. And they kept infusing their bodies and minds with the energies of the soul and the monad, the I Am Presence. So I believe that the reason mental health is declining so much in Western society is due to the habit of mindless pastimes and no real use of the intellectual faculties at all. For example, we park elders in front of a TV and some sitcom or other mindless nonsense and then wonder why they check out mentally. Who wouldn't? So I remember, I also remember going to the Ojai Grove each year to hear the great initiate philosopher and savant Jiddu Krishnamurti speak. And he was speaking and writing and teaching up into his 90s. I think he left his body at age 97 or 98. And he kept trim and toned through a moderate lifestyle, daily yoga, and walking in nature. And he looked pretty much the same his whole life. And he was, I think he was the greatest philosopher of our 20th century. So if you're interested, there is a form of yoga for every age and physical condition. And even yoga that can be done in a chair, a wheelchair, or even in bed. And many degenerative physical conditions can be reversed or even healed through regular yogic practice. Even doing yoga once a week can work wonders. And the Chinese achieve great physical and mental health and vitality through doing Tai Chi and Qigong. Therefore, a lesson I'm learning big time is that not exercising is not an option. So I'm back to my former yogic practice. And in general, you just pick something that you enjoy doing physically, whether it's swimming, walking, riding horseback, going to fitness or yoga classes, whatever, but keep your physical body flexible and strong. Now for mental health, pick a course of study that requires focus, concentration, and using your mind rigorously. Not romance novels or murder mysteries. These will pollute your mind and fill it with unwholesome and dark imagery. Don't go there. Focus your mind and be proactive in directing it into positive channels that are going to build into you greater awareness, greater enlightenment, greater understanding, greater love. And emotionally, it's important to keep connected with others. You know, home study groups or regular church or temple attendance and participation or other forms of fellowship and satsang are very important for social interaction. And not happy hours and drinking, which depletes your mind, your body, and your spiritual health. Those are not happy hours. So that's another area that we can bring into balance. And then our financial area, which many of us have been challenged in trying to come into balance and harmony with, because where many of us come from, we don't have money. And nobody really tells you how to use it. At least very few people have any kind of training in financial management. So your financial area of life and your flowing abundance is kept vitally energized by engaging in right livelihood, number one. And right livelihood is where no harm is done to anyone or anything. That's right livelihood. And then you live off of 80% of your income. Your first 10% of your gross money goes to God. And that could be tied to your place of spiritual nourishment, whether that's your church, your temple, your synagogue, whatever. Or, you know, some of us tied to Operation Blessing or other Samaritan's Purse or service organizations that are out there feeding and helping the helpless and the poor throughout the world. But whatever you do, 10% of it goes to God right off the top. And then, if you're wise, you will save or invest 10%. So you live off of 80%, you tithe 10%, and you save or invest 10%. And that is the formula for financial balance and health. I wish somebody had told me that when I was growing up. It's a bit late now, but that's what I'm trying to live by now at this point in my life. But if you could make a mistake in financial management, I've been there and done that. I didn't know about this tithing thing until later on in life. But it really, really works. So the truly wealthy person, according to Sai Baba, is the one who has conquered desire. Yeah, there's always an inner lesson. So like that, you can look at each area of your life and see where more loving attention and balance is needed. And that way you can begin to bring a beautiful order and harmony to every area of your life. And an important part of that is beginning to notice where you can put a ceiling on your desires. You know, have to get to that point where enough's enough already. The car you have, okay, maybe it's 10 years old, but it's in good condition. Deal with it. Be happy with it. You know, you don't have to have a new car every year. Appreciate your home. Maybe it's not a mansion, but if it's covering your needs for shelter and you're doing okay with it, it's enough already. You don't have to live in a mansion. So learn to live more on spiritual purpose with less attachment to material things. So it's important. And I think, you know, when you have a perspective that you have only one lifetime. That's what we're taught here in the West. You only have one lifetime and that's it. And you think you have to crowd everything into this one lifetime. I think that's what makes people so needy and so greedy and have so much avariciousness. You know, that graspy, gotta have, kind of mentality. You don't see that in cultures where they have a greater perspective of the fact that, you know, ultimately you'll have all of your desires fulfilled. You know, the pauper becomes the king becomes the pauper, the haves become the have-nots, and the have-nots become the haves. It's, you know, the karmic balance and justice behind life that makes sure everybody gets an equal experience down here of all things. So not to worry, you know, you have what you have, and it's enough already. Be happy with it. Be content. Contentment, I think, is the greatest happiness that we can have in this material life. So, you know, I think, you know, as you ask these kind of probing questions and begin to really look at your life as a lesson plan, as a curriculum of things that God has, and you and God together have decided this is what your life's about this time around. You'll also soon discover that there are many aspects and many facets to your personal expression. You're not just one thing all the time, but you're different things at different times, and different facets will catch the light, you know, as you move through your life. I find it very interesting and revealing how one's perspective, and therefore one's answers to some of the questions, change over time. And should, you know, if we're progressing. But if you go back and read your journals or things of that nature, you'll be surprised at how your responses will be different today than they were maybe 10 years ago. So in examining your current lessons, always take into consideration your specific stage in life and your particular circumstances. For example, a young college student will have a very different learning focus from, say, a 20- or 30-year-old person starting or already raising a family. If you're in your 60s or 70s or 80s, again, your life cycle and focus will be very different from those who are in their 20s and 30s and 40s and so forth. So each age and stage of life has its prescribed dharma. And in the Eastern teachings in particular, you see the dharma very carefully laid out in terms of the cycle of your life. And also in the Native American, and probably all indigenous nations, have this sense of the stages of life and honoring each stage of life. In today's modern world, I think much unnecessary suffering occurs because we have lost touch with the wisdom that guided the ancient ones. When you're, you know, again, trying to force everything into one lifetime, and you don't realize you have eternity to unfold, it makes you kind of desperate to get everything crowded in right now and yesterday, you know, if not the day before. So you often see those in their 60s and older still trying to preserve the goals and lifestyles and appearances of those people who are 20 and 30-year-olds. And this is a trend in today's modern world, which I think is the cause of so much depression and frustration and self and prescription medicating, you know, and going to the, here in California and Hollywood, in Los Angeles, you know, everybody's got their shrink. Living unnaturally, out of sync with your cycle and stage of life, makes you supremely neurotic and depressed because you can't do it. You're living by a false standard and expecting something of yourself that you're incapable, really, of maintaining and sustaining for very long. So in India, I found, especially in the simple villages, of which 80% of India is comprised, that people were living in a degree of peace and well-being almost totally lost in the big cities of both East and West. I also observed the health and vitality of the elders and the respect with which they were honored. I can't recall a single case of Alzheimer's. I don't remember ever seeing that. You practically see no one in the villages who are obese. I didn't see any evidence of any kind of juvenile gangs or juvenile delinquency. The young people were well-mannered and respectful of the elders and teachers. And I also noticed the elderly were cared for at home and not put in retirement facilities in old age. And, you know, of course, that's changing now as India imitates more of the Western attitudes and lifestyle. But when I first started going to India some 40 years ago, the lifestyle was still one remarkably different from that of the West. It was so sweet and safe, and, you know, you could just feel like you were at home with your own family wherever you moved about. Very, very loving and accommodating and safe culture. At least that was my experience. And, you know, I also learned how happily one can live with very few things. That really, we have made our lives so complicated because we in the West think we need more and more in order to be happy. And I remember returning after 4 months in India. During my first trip in 72, I kept marveling at how large our dwellings were, how in India several families could live in one of our average apartments. And I noticed how clean and orderly our outer cities were, but how much inner turmoil that most people live in. So in India, it's all noisy and crazy on the outside, but people live inside themselves in great peace. And here it's just the opposite. But I was wondering why we in America, for example, aren't totally God-realized. You know, it's so less complicated to eat and move about here in America. But what are we doing with our luxuries and leisure and the conveniences of modern society? We're basically using our time to become more and more involved in the outer world and are ignoring the inner world, where alone peace and lasting happiness reside. So I think that's the big overall lesson that we're all learning, having taken birth in Western nations, that we can adopt from those ancient cultures, which is, life is a divine gift. Creation is a divine gift to be honored and respected and cherished and taken good care of. And part of that nature is our physical bodies. And everything is meant to be used to discover the divine in and as all things. And every experience is a lesson that God would have us learn, in which we discover the divine presence. And everything is a stepping stone on our journey to God and the realization of our own divinity. Man with love is God. When you live in love, you live in God. And the difference between you and God vanishes. It is in the loving that we meet the divine. It is in the loving that we walk with God. It is in the loving that God reveals the innermost secrets of creation to his beloved. It is in the loving that you reside in perfect safety, always. No one can take that loving from you. It cannot be touched by anything in the world. And when you're in that state of divine love, the very universe itself will reach out to support and nurture and care for you. You'll find what it's like to live in true innocence. Innocence and purity are the very nature of one who has been completely washed in loving, completely cleansed in loving, completely baptized in loving, completely anointed as the love of God, which is the only and uniquely begotten of God. For God begot only love, and you are but love. So, in your life lessons, perhaps we could use this as a model. Physically, practice karma yoga. To do this, you offer your work as worship to God. You offer the fruit of your labor and its results to God. And then it is God who will fulfill those tasks by giving you the ability to do so and will take their results so that no karma accrues to your account. Now, emotionally, you can practice bhakti yoga. And this is being devoted to God, heart, mind, body, and soul. To love God and devote time to daily prayer and regular devotional practices and self-service to the people around you. Mentally, you practice jnana yoga by thinking, studying, and contemplating upon the fact that God alone is all that is, and I am one with God. A jnani yogi recognizes the divine in all things, persons, and events. So these three, beloveds, these three practices, work as worship, devotion to God expressed as service to man, and wisdom, study, inquiry, and contemplation upon who am I and who is God. Such lifestyle practices will keep you balanced and in harmony on all levels. And then you will find that you have also that mental health and that physical health that enables you to move with greater ease and grace throughout your life. Remember to keep that life in balance in every area and to periodically do an overview and see how you're using your time and your energy and your money and your attention. And the same 24/7 hours we all have, how are you spending them? With whom are you spending them? Spend the day with love. Fill the day with love. Begin the day with love. End the day with love. Live in love. Love all. Serve all. Help ever. Hurt never. That is the way to God. So let's go out chanting Ek Om Kar, which is a Sikh mantra that literally means one God, or God is one. So take a deep breath. Ek Om Kar. Very good mantra, by the way, to do on your 108 beaded Japa Mala rosary. Very good one. And you have been listening to Commander Lady Athena of the Ashtar Galactic Command in Cosmic Pep Talks, the Closet Christs. And God willing, I will be with you this time next week. Adonai.